Hello, this is Jim Wallace, and you're listening to The Soul of the Nation, a podcast about how our faith should shape our politics and not the other way around. This week on the podcast, we are bringing you a special episode, a live recording of a conversation I had at Georgetown University with Sarah McCammon, NPR's lead political correspondent and author of the new book, The Exvangelicals. In our conversation, Sarah talked about her upbringing as an evangelical in Kansas City, why she left her childhood faith, and the experience of being verbally attacked by Trump voters, the very same people she grew up with. It was a great conversation, and I hope you enjoy it. Sarah, I always like to ask my guests before we start this question. How is your spirit these days?
I have to say I prefer that question to one I heard a lot growing up, which is, how is your walk with the Lord? Because sometimes that question felt like it had an overtone of expectation, and I wasn't sure how I was supposed to answer it, but I felt like the asker had a pretty clear idea of how I was supposed to answer it. But I think I would say it's troubled at times. Mm-hmm. This is a troubled world, and it's hard not to be aware of that. In fact, I think maybe it would be unhealthy to not be mm-hmm. totally unaware of that. But it's also pretty peaceful. And if I may say so, the process of writing this book was helpful in that. In sort of, it is both memoir and reportage, and so it gave me an opportunity to reflect on a lot of things I've spent my life reflecting on, and also to talk with some wonderful people who think about these same issues that I know you think about, Jim. And at the end of that process, I think I felt a lot of peace, actually. And I just want to say how much I've admired your work for so many years. So thank you for having me here.
I read the book. It's a good read, but I can see how it helped you to really think about what you really feel. The chance to write all that down. You're reporting every day. So she's a busy day job, NPR. Mother of two boys, like I'm father of two boys. And you certainly have enough to do. So why did you decide to write this book on top of all of that?
You're right. I do have no shortage of things to do, but this book just felt, you know, I've heard other people talk about like feeling like a book was sort of almost gestating inside of them and mm-hmm. wanting to be written. And I always thought that sounded a little bit overwrought, but this one, it was kind of like that. I had been sitting with kind of this concept for several years. You know, basically in 2015 was recruited by NPR to cover the campaign cycle. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in July of 2015, when I started, I think, you know, I was assigned to cover the Republican primary. I think I thought I would be probably covering a pretty, you know, slow march by Jeb Bush to the nomination. And obviously that wasn't the way it went, but I wound up spending so much time, like so many journalists, thinking and talking about evangelicals. And of course, that's the world I came from. So I spent several years after that reflecting on what I'd seen and written about and thought about during that time and all of the questions I would get. You know, if I had a dollar for every time somebody asked me why evangelicals support Trump, I would have a lot of dollars. And so, you know, I spent several years just kind of reflecting on all of those themes, on this intersection of my personal background and my professional work. And I really felt like I had things I wanted to say to kind of answer that question. Right. And then really when January 6th, 2021 happened and people marched toward the Capitol with these religious signs and symbols, I felt like I needed to write this thing I'd been thinking about writing.
Where Jesus suffered identity theft at the Capitol, right, with his sign, his flags, and being shouted prayers to him as they took over the Senate, for example. Paint a picture, though, for us of this world you were raised in. Your schools, your churches, your books you read, the activities that you were surrounded with growing up.
Yeah, I was growing up not realizing it really at the time, but I was part of what was a growing and increasingly influential movement, which was white evangelicalism. I was, you know, born in the early 80s, right at the beginning of the Reagan administration, about 2 weeks after Reagan was first sworn in. Although I wasn't thinking about that at the time, I don't think. And, you know, my childhood was really shaped by what I now recognize as a really robust evangelical subculture that had grown up and was growing up at the time. You know, James Dobson was basically like our Pope. We wouldn't have put it that way, but my
focus on the family,
focus on James the family, Dobson. The founder, focus on the family, right? So you know, we got magazines about parenting, magazines for children, magazines about politics. We had all kinds of books that were endorsed by or written by people affiliated with Focus on the Family and so many other parachurch ministries. And political activism was just sort of baked into the culture. You know, most people I knew, I think, conflated their faith with a certain political project, and that was really by design, as I understand today. But for me, growing up, it meant that everything I knew was pretty much shaped by the church and the Christian school I went to. The textbooks that I had in school were from Bob Jones University and also Abeka, which was out of Pensacola. And, you know, I was being taught that the whole world was lost and it was our job to save it. And that meant things theologically and, again, also politically. I was taught that, you know, the Bible was literally true, just as it was written. It was a love letter from God, and all we needed to do was open it up and read it for ourselves, and we would understand the truth. But as I got older, I found that harder to accept for a lot of reasons. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was a subculture, an infrastructure with book and media empires and all the rest. But for you, there wasn't a moment or an event that turned you away from that. It was a series of moments or events that gradually you begin to feel uncomfortable and you disentangle with that world. But that's a difficult thing to do.
Right. And one of the things I write about is that today, you know, 20 plus years after I sort of made my, you know, very quiet, complicated, painful exit from evangelicalism, not from faith, but from evangelicalism for a whole lot of reasons. I, you know, at that time, there was no real language for it. But today, because of the internet, and one of the things I focus on in the book is the really robust kind of internet culture around words like deconstruction. And even the term evangelical is one that was sort of born as a hashtag on the internet. And what I found kind of accidentally through the course of some of my reporting, I came across this, is that there are a lot of people of my generation and a little older and a little younger who are sort of processing their faith in this way and have a lot to talk about.
The word, get it right now, evangelical. That's on the book. So I've been doing podcasts with the new evangelicals, the post-evangelicals. I'm waiting for the adjacent evangelicals. That's one of their popular phrases. But around this whole subculture, there are people who are moving away. And you talk about especially a lot of evangelical white women are moving away. So describe that world. It's not an organization. It's a number of networks, particularly now in the podcast world.
Right.
People are really in touch with each other, and they're in this sort of adjacent ex-new, ex-evangelical world. So describe that for these folks.
Yeah.
Some might be from that year. Some have no idea what we're talking about. So describe that culture.
There's what seems to be kind of a burgeoning language and set of sort of labels for this experience, and people do call it different things. I chose ex-evangelical for the title because I thought it was, frankly, succinct and kind of said very simply, one came from this culture and for whatever reason no longer is part of it. But you're right. There are now podcasts, Facebook groups, TikTok influencers, and people kind of land in a lot of different places. You know, some people end up with a very strong Christian identity, but a different kind of Christian identity, and other people are not religious. But what's kind of in common is having spaces to talk about that experience, which can be, and I think, you know, decades ago, before there was social media, I think it could be a very isolating, very scary experience. And you're right, Jim, I think a lot of I think that the movement, such as it is a movement, is disproportionately female. Some of the data that I've seen, it's early and we don't have a whole lot of data, but the data that I've seen seems to support that, and certainly anecdotally. And I think that's not a surprise.
You know, more women than men are leaving?
I think that's the case, okay. Yes.
And why?
I don't think it should be a huge surprise. Women in many evangelical spaces have been kind of systematically marginalized, mm-hmm. not allowed to be in leadership roles, told that their, to one extent or another, their role in life is fairly limited. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to paint with too broad of a brush, because sure. I think within evangelicalism, there's a range of views on these things. But, you know, growing up, I got a lot of messages about being a wife and mother being the highest and most important calling. And those are beautiful callings, and that's part of my life. But mm-hmm. I always wanted other things too. And then, you know, if you talk about purity culture and modesty and all of the expectations that are put on young evangelical girls about covering up, about not tempting men, you know, I think this is true in a lot of conservative religious cultures, not just evangelicalism, but it's one that a lot of the women I've encountered in these spaces have really struggled with. So I don't think it's a big surprise that women, given other options, would go elsewhere.
Always aimed at the women, because we know boys will be boys, and they're let off the hook. So it's always a focus on women. Your book creates space for these conversations, which I really appreciated. So it's tough when you got that kind of world surrounding you, and you're the kind of young woman already reading, thinking, pondering things that would end you up as an NPR reporter. So you're already thinking about things as a young kid in this world surrounds you, trying to close you off from even that kind of thinking about the future.
You know, one of the things that I say in the book is I feel in retrospect like I became a journalist in part because I was very interested in questions, and I felt like some of the answers I was given felt unsatisfying. You know, I would ask my high school teachers about the Bible and how it was put together and how we knew, how did we know that it was really what God wanted us to have, because we put so much emphasis on it. And I got answers that I found unsatisfying. And, you know, I had a lot of questions about science, you know, being taught young earth creationism. But I think for me, journalism was a place where questions were valued and were really part of the process in a way that felt exhilarating and freeing.
But as I read your book, you were always feeling these questions, even as a young kid. You were thinking about these things. That you'd become a journalist is not surprising, because you were thinking early about all these kinds of things. You use the word, of course, deconstruction. Mm-hmm. So what did it mean for you and other people? In your book, the book's full of stories about other people. She's met some well-known, some not so well-known, but about their deconstruction. So where do people, what does that mean to deconstruct that world? And then where do you go then for some reconstruction? Or where do you go? Where do you end up?
Yeah, it's not my word, but I think it's one that I have run across in these ex-evangelical or post-evangelical or evangelical adjacent spaces. And I think it has its origins in the writings of the philosopher and literary critic Jacques Derrida. Mm-hmm. But people use it in when it comes to religion in a somewhat different way. And I think quite simply what it seems to mean is rethinking, reexamining, questioning, you know, sort of turning things up inside out and upside down and trying to determine what feels true, what resonates, what doesn't. The reconstructing part is harder. I flick at that in the book. I don't talk about it as much. I think maybe there's another book there for someone to write. But, you know, there's so many people, not just evangelicals, who are disaffiliating from organized religion. I mean, that is a huge trend in American religion across the board, as I'm sure you're well aware. And the data that I've seen about people who disaffiliate is that many of them retain a belief in God or an interest in spirituality, but maybe a discomfort with institutions and churches for a variety of reasons. But where they go next is a harder question. And I think that, you know, the answers are depend on the person. Some people it's another religious tradition. Other people it's sort of chosen family or other communities that they build in other places.
According to one survey you cite in your book, about one third of Americans raised in evangelical households leave the tradition as adults. And if you figure that evangelicals make up about 20% of the American population, that's a huge figure.
Yeah, David Gushee has estimated something like 25 million Americans are ex-evangelicals. You know, I was talking to somebody at the Public Religion Research Institute recently. She said she thinks it's more like 10 million. You know, I think
it's a big number.
It's a big number because evangelicalism is a big movement. And certainly when I was growing up, for anybody in the millennial generation, it was something like close to 1 in 4 Americans. And yeah. So if you figure that, again, disaffiliation is a trend across the board in American religion, it's a lot of people who have been in some kind of church and are no longer.
Yeah. A lot of my Georgetown students would check the box for religious affiliation, none, mm-hmm. none of the above. And some say they're fallen Catholics. So no, you're just questioning, right? So, but the none of the aboves are not, in my view, a secular movement. Most still believe in God or something bigger than themselves.
Right.
And are trying to figure out where to go or what to think. And the things that they most want to see are authenticity and courage.
And I think inclusion.
Inclusion.
One of the big reasons people cite for leaving churches is the way that churches talk about LGBTQ people. And this is true, again, across the board. And I think that, you know, that is a major generational shift that we've seen in our country, much more acceptance and inclusion of LGBTQ people. And so it's no surprise that people would want that from their churches as well.
On that question, I really was struck in your book by your gay grandfather. Mm-hmm. And how you always prayed at the table that he would leave all that and come to Christ. And that was a big, you were close to him. Mm-hmm. And that was a big thing in your life that was always there for you. Tell us a little bit about your gay grandfather. He's a great character in the book.
He, for much of my childhood, was sort of the symbol of the lost, the unsaved, mm-hmm. that we, you know, as evangelicals, you're taught to evangelize, to share your faith. And so, because as I mentioned, so much of my world was church and Christian school, there weren't a lot of people to evangelize. but there were a few people in my extended family who, were not religious, were not evangelical. And we spent a lot of time, you know, most nights at dinner, we would sort of as a rote prayer, almost pray for grandpa to get saved. It was mostly focused on my grandpa. And I describe in the book how I came to discover as I got a little bit older that his roommate was not just his roommate. And that was one of the reasons that we, you know, while we cared about him and we saw him at holidays and prayed for him, we didn't spend a lot of time together. Mm-hmm. You know, I never spent the night at his house. And I, as I describe, I came to find out it wasn't because he didn't want to spend time with me. Mm-hmm. And so that was, you know, for in many ways, a painful discovery to learn sure. that there was this distance and the reasons for it. And for me, it was part of my journey of learning to include and to accept and to think about difference in a different way than I had been taught.
But being marginalized like he was for so long, still the end of your book, you talk about the advice he always gave you, that life is about helping other people, mm-hmm. which I thought quite striking.
And he devoted his life to helping other people. You know, he was a
brain surgeon.
Right? he loved, you know, some of my family members have told me stories about watching him get down on the floor with little kids in the pediatric ward and, you know, help play with their trains or their toys. You know, which is a side that I never really got to see of him growing up because we weren't so close, but it's beautiful for me to know that that was there. And that was, you know, as a physician, what he dedicated his life to.
Mm-hmm. So you're a reporter. So let's turn to politics. You write, this is from you in the book, "For many evangelicals of my parents' era, decades of political activism and careful curation of alternative media and educational institutions culminated with the election of Donald Trump. same time you say the Trump phenomenon has seemed like a bright light suddenly flicked on in a dark house, exposing every crack in the foundation. Say more about that. What did Trump expose, and how was Trump, Donald Trump, the culmination of evangelicals like your parents' political activism?
When I was covering the 2016 campaign, when people I knew would sort of connect the dots and realize that I was, you know, both somebody who'd come from the evangelical subculture and was in many ways covering it, they would always ask me, you know, some version of the question, why do evangelicals support Donald Trump?
You've been asked that question too.
I've been asked it a few times. And what do you make of this?
Yeah.
And I will say, I think thinking back to the primary, I think part of me thought that there would be a breaking point, like so many people did, where the evangelical movement would rally behind someone else. I remembered very well what it was like growing up in the 90s when evangelical leaders like James Dobson and others were denouncing Bill Clinton's, infidelity.
His lack of character.
Mm-hmm. Right. That was a major drumbeat. I was 16, 17 when that was going on. And I remember that very well. So I thought that there would be a breaking point. But then as soon as Trump was the nominee or the presumptive nominee, it was really clear that those who hadn't already rallied behind him were going to. And in retrospect, you know, looking back and thinking about the rhetoric I heard growing up, the messages which were even kind of embedded in some of my textbooks, which I cite, this idea that America was in decline because it had moved away from being a Christian nation, that it was always designed to be. And this idea that, I would hear evangelicals all of my life quote, I think it's the verse in Chronicles, if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and turn from their wicked ways, I will hear from heaven and heal their land. You know, this one.
Yeah.
And that was like a motto for evangelicals
sure.
in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
And it was, of course, it had nothing to do with the United States of America, but it was adopted as, a vision for restoring America. So when Trump got up and said, I'm going to make America great again, I think that resonated with many evangelicals, and it wasn't that different of a message from what they'd been hearing from their pastors and their political leaders for a very long time.
So it was a culmination.
So it was not that hard to understand how it happened.
Yeah. You mentioned the breaking points. Remember, like, there was always one after another that we're sure the media would be a breaking point,
right.
Like Access Hollywood.
Right.
So character counts with Bill Clinton, but not finally with Donald Trump. So that reversal of the character narrative happened in this case.
You know, and I would put this question to evangelical voters and others, and they would say, look, it's a binary choice between someone who will promote our policy views and someone who won't. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people like James Dobson and others said things like, you know, Trump's not a perfect man, but neither am I. We heard, you know, him famously compared to King Cyrus, right? Who was a Persian king who was considered sort of fallen and pagan, but nonetheless was, you know, in the Bible used by God to God's purposes. And so we started to hear these narratives develop around Trump as somebody who could be used by God. And, you know, I think the most famous one was maybe when Tony Perkins said, you know, everybody gets a mulligan, everybody gets another chance. And so we did see a reversal. But, you know, I think, you know, you fast forward to 2024 and once again, even given other options, evangelicals have backed Trump and have been instrumental in making him the presumptive nominee, which I think speaks to the fact that they've not only made peace with whatever his character foibles may be, but they've in many ways embraced him and embraced what he is able to bring to the table in terms of accomplishing political and ideological goals.
So the most recent examples of all that have come out since your book and since my book were published, it's like a candidate for president is selling Bibles, and he makes all the money from them for legal fees for this trial or whatever. And then
he posted something just a couple of weeks ago where he's in court like he is now at a table, defense table, and there he is. And next to him, what he posted was this figure of Jesus.
Right, it was a cartoon, Trump and Jesus in court together,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I'm not sure which was the cartoon, but it was Trump and Jesus in court together. And the language came out, I'm being indicted for you. Now, that's language that you and I know from that world. As a journalist, when you see that and cover that, what does that make you think or feel?
It's interesting because as a journalist, but also as a journalist who has the background that I have and that you have, I do hear those words and I understand exactly what they mean.
That's right.
And I feel like, again, part of the reason I wrote the book, I didn't really ask to play this role, but the last several years I've found myself kind of accidentally in these spaces where everything I knew and heard growing up is sort of right there, again, at the
right
center of our
again.
Politics. Yeah. And I sometimes feel like for those of us who know what that means, it becomes our job to almost translate it and explain it.
It's striking to me that you're all of us as journalists, you're covering the world you came from leaps up in front of you,
mm-hmm.
and now you're covering it.
Mm-hmm.
So the stories in your book about how you'd be out being a journalist on the road, and a lot of journalists I know were frightened often at those rallies, and they felt they're being called the enemy of the people and all of that, and you're being yelled at and with some probably some bad language from people who were your people. I mean, you didn't know them, but they were your people you grew up with, and here they are yelling at you and really debasing reporters. That must have been a tough professional and personal thing at the same time.
Yeah, some of my liberal friends would say, I don't know how many times I heard, I don't know how you can stand to be in a Trump rally, cover a Trump rally. And, you know, for me, it wasn't that big of a deal. Like, I am a white woman who grew up in the Midwest in church and, you know, and grew up in a charismatic evangelical church, right? I'm used to, like, excited, enthusiastic, over-the-top crowds. So I could go
explain that to the charismatic.
So charismatic is a sort of a movement within Christianity, and it intersects with and overlaps with evangelicalism, but is not identical to it. But my church would be described as both evangelical and charismatic. But charismatic means it involves, you know, speaking in tongues, often believing in miracles, laying hands on people, praying for them when they're sick, and believing that God could directly heal them. Sometimes people in church would get what they called a word of the Lord, and they would believe that God was speaking directly to them, and they would come up and speak to the congregation. It was this very sort of emotional and very present view of God. And it's a strain of American Christianity that remains very powerful. And in fact, a lot of Trump's high profile Trump supporting pastors are from the charismatic tradition. Paula White, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So I could go to these rallies and, you know, I felt like I was sort of fluent in the culture, and it wasn't that unusual for me.
It was familiar.
Until Trump would stand up on the stage and sort of rile up the crowd and point to the back of the room where we were sitting and, you know, say, look at those people back there, those reporters, they're the worst people. They're disgusting. And the temperature of the room would really shift. And,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, it was stark to see the same people who often right beforehand were very friendly with me kind of turning on us, you know, literally turning and looking at us and very angry, directing a lot of their anger at us, because I think we became symbols of something else
mm-hmm.
in people's minds.
And the Jesus that they say they believe in once said in the Gospel of John, you will know the truth and the truth will make you free. And to me, that passage is deeper than just the opposite of truth is lying. The opposite of truth is captivity. Truth mm-hmm. and freedom are indivisible. Mm-hmm. And so you're dealing with captive people. And they believe they've lost the truth, and that makes them captive. A lot of the people that we grew up with, they're captivated by these big lies, they're captivated by this ideology of white Christian nationalism, even if they don't know it or could say it. So as a journalist, your vocation is to seek the truth, right? And that's supposed to be vocation of pastors, I would suggest as well, and people of faith. But you're trying to be a journalist with the truth, and you see the truth being violated all around you, and people who are captive, I would say, to lies coming after you.
You know, as a journalist, I'm not going to pass judgment on who's captive and who's free.
But what you saw was pretty...
I think that's a beautiful take on that verse, and it's not one that I had thought about in that way before, that mm-hmm. that sort of opposition between yeah. truth and captivity as right. opposed to truth and lies. I think, you know, one of the things that as journalists we've had to contend with the last several years is how to deal with lies. Mm-hmm. And misinformation and lies and also hateful speech. You know, the last several years have been a time of, I think, rapid growth of misinformation and of a lot of vitriol and mm-hmm. some of that. And that's, you know, I think it's been escalating the last several years. And so one of the things we have to contend with is how to talk about those things, how to discuss them in a way that's responsible.
So you say, the only thing that got you through some of that was meditating on a Bible lesson you learned as a child.
Yeah.
What was that lesson?
Yeah, there was this weird moment, and it was right at the end of the campaign. And, you know, the last few days before an election, if you're a campaign reporter, are really, really awful. It's, you know, going from campaign stop to campaign stop. It doesn't matter who you're covering. It's awful because there's no sleep and you're on buses and planes and filing without Wi-Fi, and it's exhausting. And so I think, you know, a couple of days before the 2016 election, we were in that last swing. I was covering that last swing. I was really burned out. And we got to one of these rallies, and it was in the Detroit suburbs, and the crowd was just particularly angry, and mm-hmm. we'd been in a lot of angry crowds, and it was something I was used to, but I was kind of fried and raw, and it felt especially uncomfortable. And I just, you know, I just had this moment. It kind of made me understand how, like, people, yeah. religious mystics, maybe feel when they are going through something really stressful, like out in the desert, and you know, you have these spiritual experiences. Because I did. I had this moment where I was looking at this angry crowd, and I felt like people wanted to get a reaction out of us. Like they, you know, they're yelling and pointing and they're so mad and they wanted us to be mad back. And I just thought about Jesus. I just thought about, you know, this idea of turning the other cheek and loving, you know, love your enemies, do good to those who hurt you. And that, you know, and I am not a particularly religious person. I had a lot of distance from the faith of my childhood at that point. But it was like this, it wasn't like I went looking for that. I'm not mm-hmm. the kind of person who goes right. looking for a Bible verse to think about. But it just came to me. And uh-huh. I think it's one of those beautiful things that, you know, sometimes faith is just something that happens to you. And I think it's most powerful when that happens, because I really felt like I drew strength from that idea. Like mm-hmm. you don't have to fight back. You don't have to respond with anger. You don't have to feed the cycle. That's not always easy to do, and it's not always possible to do. But in that moment, I felt that sort of strengthened by my faith in a way that I really didn't expect.
So when those who say they're followers of Jesus attack and throw hate at journalists, and a journalist thinks of Jesus at that moment and how he calls us to love our enemies, there's something in that. Sort of moment that is very revealing of what faith is supposed to mean. Indeed. So Jesus didn't say, blessed are the peace lovers, because we're all at peace. He didn't say, blessed are the peacekeepers, because that often just keeps the lid on an unjust status quo. He says, blessed are the peacemakers. So you're a journalist. They're being conflict makers, not peacemakers. And there you are, remembering the words of Jesus in response to them. I find that to be quite a moment.
It was for me, and it's not the kind of thing that happens to me very often, yeah, I'll be honest. Yeah. But it was helpful in that moment.
So you say the world you grew up in, old textbooks. Mm-hmm. We're talking about libraries before. Books are important to you, textbooks that were made to study at your Christian schools. And you're right, As I leaf through those old textbooks, today I'm stunned and ashamed at what I naively and uncritically accepted as a young student decades ago. White Christian nationalism was as invisible in that environment and seemingly as natural as the air we breathed. Looking back now, what are some of those things that you say now stun you? And where do you see in retrospect that white Christian nationalism showing up, even in elementary school and high school for you?
So one of the things I did to write this book was I was obviously drawing on a lot of my memories from many years ago. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to, I didn't want people to just take my word for it.
Yeah.
So in addition to pulling my old journal entries and some of my old exchanges, correspondence, I went online and bought a bunch of old used textbooks from the same textbook companies that my school had used. Mm-hmm. And I tried to look at the covers and remember which ones I'd had. And so, these were mostly Bob Jones and Abeka, as well as a lot of sort of Christian living books from people like Tam LaHaye and James Dobson and others. But the textbooks, you know, there were a couple that stood out to me. I mean, one of them talked about Christopher Columbus in kind of heroic, glowing terms, which if you study anything about Christopher Columbus, he was a real jerk, a really bad guy. And I think by any standard.
Sex trafficking and doing all kinds of things, yeah.
And, all kinds of oppression of indigenous people and the like. And you know, that wasn't talked about at all. And this was sort of in the context of framing the founding of America as God's design and divinely appointed. Mm-hmm. There was a really horrific line that described slavery in the South as it said, this isn't an exact quote, but it's close, but it said that the summer air was warm and the slaves stayed healthy. And this was in a Christian textbook for Christian kids who were supposed to be followers of Christ. Right. And to read those things in those books was, you know, I didn't remember those lines, but right. It was kind of it was very shocking. I mean, it was worse than I remembered it. And I'm, you know, and I want to be careful. I think if you pushed many of the parents at my school, if you brought them that and said, really, is this what you believe? They would go, oh no, you know, that's actually not good. Mm-hmm. But nobody seemed to care enough to be alarmed by it or make an issue of it. And I think that says a lot about the values and priorities that, you know, the things we did and did not prioritize.
Yeah. I think the name spells the problem. I mean, here's this inclusive, welcoming, inviting vision of the gospel, and it's made into white, you know, or Christian, but they don't mean service and love and sacrifice. They mean control and domination. And then nationalists, Jesus said, go into all the world, make disciples, teaching them to observe what I've taught you, and then make a nationalist. So, and you're saying it goes back before Trump to this whole bubble, you grew up, the subculture, infrastructure of industry and money and media. And this is now the culmination. What I often say is, my own view, I'll say Trump is not a leader, he's a marketer. And he markets a racial grievance, but he's also marketing our nation's worst demons. And every nation has better angels and worse demons. And our worst demons are being marketed now. And I can't predict what's going to happen in Pennsylvania, in Michigan, and Wisconsin, how our worst demons are going to do. But it is better angels up against worst demons. Given that, you can't talk about evangelical in the United States without talking about race. So Jamar Tisby is a mutual friend. You talk to him about your book. The issue of how does race show up in your own experience of white evangelicalism, particularly in your education, and more broadly, as you see that being covered, the difference in black evangelicals like Jamar and white evangelicals.
Yeah. You know, I've heard from friends that I didn't even interview for the book. I talked to them afterwards. There were, you know, very few people of color in my school and church. And some of them have told me about some of the experiences they had of being, you know, experiencing explicit racism, sadly. Right. But I talked to, you know, as I was researching the book, I came across this sort of another hashtag, another online movement, because that's where so many things happen now, called Leave Loud, which was a push by Black Christians, including Dr. Jamar Tisby and others, to encourage Black Christians who had experienced marginalization in predominantly white evangelical spaces to leave and to say why they were leaving. And this kind of came to a head for a lot of people I talked to around the beginning of the Trump movement, also with the way their churches responded to, you know, the police killing of George Floyd. I interviewed, you know, several people for the chapter on race who talked about churches paying lip service, at least expressing a desire to be more integrated and racially diverse. But when push came to shove, feeling like the people in the pews next to them were not prioritizing their well-being.
So The Color of Compromise by Jamar Tisby, a must read. His story being converted in that world and then having to shout against it.
Right.
Yeah. There is a paragraph that is at the end of this book that I really thought said a lot. And I normally don't ask people to read from their books, but I found this and I thought it's worth a read, and she offered to do a read. So here's a little paragraph at the end. You can explain it, but just to read, that's a good ending to this first part. Then we'll open it to you. Questions?
Near the end, I'm sort of talking about, to the extent that I've arrived anywhere, where I've arrived, and the fact that many ex-evangelicals arrive in different places, and I think it, in all honesty, it's an ongoing journey. Mm-hmm. But this is kind of how I describe some of my thinking. As for me, I'm still attached to the story of Jesus, the thought of God inhabiting the human experience, knowing the joys and deep suffering and vulnerability of embodiment resonates with me. I'm moved by Jesus's love for the weak and the needy. I'm inspired by his call to sacrifice one's own comfort because of a commitment to a larger good. And I see that kind of selflessness as essential for a functional community. I'm convicted, to use an evangelical word, by his warnings about how easy it is to be distracted from that mission by selfish desires and the pull to accumulate things that won't last.
For more Soul of the Nation updates, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review, and follow me on Twitter @JimWallace if you like. Blessings for the Soul of the Nation. Thank you all.